may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. It is season 2 of Torah Pearls, and I'm Jono. Joining me in the virtual studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net, and tired from his swim all the way from his beach of origin in New York all the way back to Jakarta, Indonesia, is the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volumes 1 and 2. You can get a copy from his website, outreachjudaism.org. That's outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tobias Singer.
Hey, great to be back with you, and great to be in the warm weather. Just escaped a snowstorm that hit New York.
Oh my goodness, the snowstorm. It's like, what is it, a meter or two of snow?
I don't know. I think Al Gore, America's former vice president and proponent of global warming, is in therapy right now. There's probably, it really was cold, you know. People may think I'm something fancy or not. I'm not. I don't take risks. I don't like fancy weather. If I want to take a risk in my life, I get on a rocking chair and that's it. And it was really getting cold in New York when I left. It was like, just, you know, that kind of cold that goes right through your bones. Yeah. And boy, let me tell you, you know, I took off, the plane took off out of Newark on the 17th of this month, on November, and landed on the 19th, like the 18th. November 18th simply evaporated from my calendar. Landed on the 19th in Jakarta.
That's the whole night.
Yeah. And it was like one in the morning. And I'm guessing it was about, I don't know, 90 degrees, maybe 29 Celsius. I mean, but humid. It's like that
humid
steam bath. And I'm going, wow, I guess this equator thing was really true. So I guess landing roughly within a few meters of the equator makes a really big difference. This whole thing with the world is round really is true.
Well, it's good to have confirmation. Yeah. So you didn't swim. You're telling me you took the plane. Curiously, if you'd stayed a couple more days, are the planes grounded in New York at the moment?
You know, I don't really know. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'll tell you honestly. When I landed and I turned on the news and I saw that our enemy had butchered dear rabbis that I knew personally, a giant, that, and just butchered them. I have no words. That's all I kept saying, is I have no words. I have the words. There's so many thoughts that just can't come out. I'm returning to the air next, shortly. I'm on air, but, I'm really in a state of grieving the enormity of not just the loss, the depravity of it all and so on. Is, you know, let's say someone doesn't like Arabs or doesn't like some group. Let's say someone doesn't like whatever group, doesn't like, I don't know, whatever. No one would ever think of going and killing an Arab child. It's just so beyond. Who would take a hatchet? Let's say someone doesn't like Aborigines, whatever. We'll stick them in a gas chamber. We're dealing with a really a depraved nation. And, you know, as Jason, you and I, we're going through Genesis, we're in this book, we're really seeing laid out the character of different nations before us. We're watching with our eyes. So there really is, you can't disbelieve, you can't walk away from this book of Genesis. We are looking at we'll be talking about this, but the characters of different nations that they will have, and we're seeing that, observing it before our eyes now. So yeah, I was in shock.
It's been a devastatingly sad week, and with that slaughter in the synagogue of the four rabbis and the Druze policeman who also died, five people, absolutely devastating. And and that's not all. It was only weeks before that Yehuda Glick was shot. Fortunately, he's making a recovery in hospital.
And we mustn't forget the pedestrians that were run down by those crazy psychopaths in the cars.
That's right.
It seems that anything is a weapon. I think, there's a lot of talk with ISIS, and a lot of different places are saying, well, don't publicize the event and then they won't get so much power from it. But in this instance, it's really important to publicize the events that are happening in Israel, because they're so mispublicized through the press. CNN called the synagogue a mosque. Their headline read, "Police shot two Palestinians dead," when it should have said, "Police shot two Palestinians killed," and then four people. But if people don't step up and let the world see what's actually happening, then the world is fed a ton of misinformation, and that just perpetuates this giant lie.
I'll just say something that is counterintuitive, but historically, it is these very events that save the Jewish people. These are kabonot. I don't mean that as some sort of atonement, but these, those who lost their lives, sacrificed their lives, saved the lives of thousands and thousands, countless people in the land of Israel, because the events that we see before us, like earlier events, have strengthened the resolve of the state of Israel. It is ultimately the citizens of Israel who determine their leadership, and their leadership will follow their citizens. They understand that. And therefore, these kinds of events throughout history, throughout Jewish history, have forced Jewish people into a position where where they will alter the decision-making process in the future, and it will many thousands of lives will be saved, as was the case at the end of the 19th century, when in cities like Kishinev and Moldova and so on, there were pogroms. Jews were killed just like this, and Jews fled. We've talked about this many times. B'domai chayi, we say this at a bris milah, at a circumcision, that the Jewish people have always lived by their blood. So God will judge, and the promises will be kept, and the nation is returning to the God of Israel like never before. And her determination and moral clarity is fine-tuned, because we're living in a time where there is just no gray. There's just, we have very much a good and evil. That's what we see before. That's what's set up. It's just good and evil. There's no gray here.
That's so true. There's no gray. And so it's been a challenging week for Jews around the world, certainly for Israel, and Jews in Israel. And this is a challenging Torah portion. There's a lot that we can take out of it that relates to what's going on. So we are in Vayetzer, which is Genesis 28, verse 10 to chapter 32, verse 3, I do believe, and it begins like this. It says, "Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran, and so he came to a certain place, and he stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to the heavens, and there the messengers of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the east and to the west and the north and the south. And you, and in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you.' And then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it.' And he was afraid, and he said, 'How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven.' And then Jacob arose early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put at his head, and he set it up as a pillar and poured oil. He anointed it. He poured oil on top of it, and he called the name of that place Bet-El, but the name was previously called Luz. But then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you.'" Tovia.
Yeah. As you're speaking, my mind is going. The themes that are so seared into every one of these portions are unfolding once again. We've talked about the book of Genesis and how we have the earth and the heavens. And we are there to see, to be able to elevate the physical into the spiritual. That's been the theme. There are going to be two dreams that we're going to encounter in this portion of the Torah of Vayetzer. This first dream, Jacob sees a ladder. And the ladder is, it's very clear. The text wants you to understand the ladder is in the ground, but the top of the ladder is in heaven, and angels are going up and down, and this is the place in which prayers and with messages are going back and forth. So Jacob is seeing before him the lay of God's plan for mankind, and that is that we may perceive that the heavens are a place, the chasm between heaven and earth is basically just the breach is too great to be connected. And the messages in this fabulous dream, perhaps the most famous of all, and that is, no, there is a direct connection between earth and heaven, and you can connect them. That's very important. We're going to see the language of the earth constantly. Even the nation will be as the dust of the earth. And incidentally, I'm shaking as I say this. Before Isaiah 53, we come to Isaiah 52, where we're talking about Israel, and the singular is a woman. And the text says there, Uri, arise, arise. In verse 2, it says, shake off the dust from you and sit, you daughter of Jerusalem. So what we're having here is this earth is very much the nation of Israel, but you can connect to heaven. You don't need what Paul will call, we have, you know, a God, and then we have one mediator. That is the idolatry. Maimonides asks a question in his most well-known philosophical work called Mori Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. And he asks the question of how did idolatry start? I mean, after all, Adam, Eve, they may have made mistakes, but they knew there was one God. What happened? I mean, and what happens is that this is precisely the problem, that people believe that they cannot approach God. That God is so great and furious and mighty. We are so filthy and worthless. We're nothing. We're totally depraved. We need a mediator between us. So the beginning of idolatry is really not perceiving the message that has been being conveyed here. And the conveying is that the physical and the spiritual are deeply connected. We're going to get to it, I know, but I have to juxtaposition the two dreams. There's going to be the dream later on, and the dream later on, this is so delicious. I'm on air, so I don't want to cry. The dream later on is going to be precisely the same vision, and that is that Jacob is going to figure out that he's got to leave Laban's home. There's a transition where Jacob has realized he spent too much time in Laban's house, and he's got to get out. And what the question is, what exactly prompted this? The text sort of puts it in, but what happens is a very strange thing, and that is we're told about the dream after the dream. I mean, the text reads through, and then afterwards, Jacob describes a dream, which actually we're never told about. But in the dream, he sees the cattle. That means he sees the materialism, and he knows he has to get back to the land of Israel. So in the land of Israel is the place that is sacred, that is holy. This is the place of Mount Moriah, which is brought into view. This is the place that all the prayers flow through. This is the place that all the messengers go up and down. This is the place that heaven kisses earth. We will be, with God's help, in the land of Israel on a tour. And you'll actually see this quite literally when looking at the mountains that surround Jerusalem. And you can actually see that literally they're the mountains, Mount Zion, Mount of Olives, and you have like the neck and the shoulders, and that's Mount Moriah. And according to Jewish tradition, I should explain, there are a lot of anomalies here that are only perceivable in the Hebrew, not in the English. Well, one of the strange things, of course, is Bet El is a bit north of Jerusalem. So what's happening here is that Jacob is somehow he's in Bet El, and in fact, there is a tradition. That means when we're doing the tour, what I'm going to show you and what the guide is going to show you is what we know for sure. I will say to you, there's a tradition, this place is this. There is a tradition, we have the place where Jacob actually had the dream. It's right outside the Jewish community in Benjamin, which is the north. It's only a 40-minute drive. But it's interesting that if you look at the language is literally the land, Vayifka, the land literally came to him. Literally, so there's a tradition that literally the land collapsed, which means he's in Bethel, which is about 30-40 minute drive from Jerusalem. So you have these two places, and he's what's happening here is literally the land is collapsing, and Jacob is able to, in a dream, it doesn't have to physically happen, but in a dream, he's able to see everything that's going to happen. Everything that has happened, everything will happen, is saying, no, you can do it. You can connect to God through the physical into the spiritual, and that chasm is not too great for you. The law is not too far off that you say, who will go over the ocean to bring it to me? It's not in heaven that you say, who will bring it to us? It is near to you. You can do it. And of course, that text is going to be surgically molested. I'm using strong words because I'm using strong words, and I'll do it because I want to draw. I really am not trying to offend Christian listeners, but I know that if you're listening to the show and you're a Christian, you don't want applesauce. You don't want the kind of food they serve in a nursing home. When Paul takes out this text in Romans 10, 6 through 8, and that you may do it, that means there isn't that gulf. There isn't the theology of Calvin and Augustine, of Tulip, of total depravity of man, and therefore a mediator is necessary. He takes out the word that you can do it. And that's what's coming into view here. What's happening here is Jacob is seeing that that heaven and earth are connected, and everything about Judaism, if you want to reduce it, what are we all doing? Why is Judaism such a physical religion? Why is it that means we eat, we are on festivals as eating, we drink? You know, a lot of people convert to Judaism and they go to synagogue for the first time in their pursuit of being a Jew, wanting to be part of the Jewish people. And one of the strange things they see is we drink wine. They're shocked that the people who came from some Baptist background where alcohol was forbidden and Jews are having a little schnapps. I never saw alcoholics when I was growing up. But the key of being a Jew is taking the physical and raising it up to the spiritual. And there is, God is so accessible, he's right there. And if you believe that you cannot connect to God, that there is no ladder, then you really do need another God that's going to intervene. And that's what Christianity really is. It's saying that you can't, that's not just Christianity, that's the whole Greco-Roman world. Sure, Jupiter or Zeus is up there, but they didn't, no one prayed to Jupiter or Zeus. So they're basically the equivalent of Roman and Greek gods. But that's the big God that created the whole universe. Mm-hmm. What we see, if I may, is really a Gnostic. I'm going on here, but this is so important. When you see Paul preaching, as an example, that it's best to be like me. Paul apparently was never married. And he's saying that the ideal is to not be married, to not indulge in intimacy. You're going to see throughout this chapter that Jacob is looking at Rachel and he saw her beauty and he wanted to take that beauty and serve God with that beauty. Why is there such an emphasis placed on the physical beauty of the matriarchs? They're stunning, they're striking looking women. Well, was Jacob really blown over that Rachel obviously was very attractive? Sarah, obviously a very, very beautiful woman. But really, what is being conveyed in all these chapters that these women are so beautiful? Why aren't the patriarchs higher than this, that they want more than just a very, very attractive girl? What's happening here? No, what they're doing is they're taking the best and they're saying, I want to build a Jewish home. That means take something beautiful that's physical, and I want to raise up this physical attraction that I have, and I want to serve God with it. Heaven forbidden one should say that intimacy with a wife is forbidden. These are the ideas that have poisoned Christianity. And although Christian scholars will tell you that Gnostic Christianity and Marcionite movement, which are different, but there are things in common. The subject is too complex to go into now. But these ideas preached in the church were that basically the physical world is not the best thing. And, you know, that's why the celibacy, people think that celibacy began 1,000 years ago. Catholic priests and leaders were the idea of celibacy is very, very old, because that is the Gnostic idea that this physical is really not of God. These two cannot be connected. And that ideally, you should be like me, Paul. But if you cannot control yourself, you need some sexual outlet. All right, so then it's better to be married than to burn. I'm quoting directly for those who haven't read it.
That's what he says.
He says it exactly. What does that mean? What kind of filth is that? Here, if we see that, no, Torah wants it. You know, there's a mitzvah, 630 commandments. Do you know that there is a mitzvah for a man to give his wife pleasure during the act of intimacy. Ve'inuosa, the Torah says. People don't know that. It's forbidden for a Jewish man to just, you know, gratify himself. There is actually no commandment for a woman to give her husband physical pleasure. That means beyond, there's a mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply. That means that is a mitzvah to actually have children. There's actually a unique mitzvah. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs to give your wife pleasure. A Jewish man or a child of God is not, you don't just pop in and say, I'm going to do what I need. No, you must bring your wife physical pleasure. What is that? What kind of God is that? He's saying, well, Hashem created that. Hashem made it delicious. Hashem made apples. Why does he give us 40 different kinds of apples? Red, yellow, one apple. No, Hashem wants to take the apples. Thank you, Hashem, for all these different apples and pears, so many types. Look at this. I'm going to serve you with this. I'm going to serve you with this intimate relationship with life. I'm going to take this glass of wine. I'm going to sanctify the Sabbath. That's everything that's happening there. So therefore, there's so much to say. I'm on the verge of tears. I'm probably emotionally, obviously very, very, we all are very emotionally spent. But that's everything here. Now, we are also observing, we're going to observe the characters that are coming to play. Maisa avay simon labonim. If you don't know that, then you're wasting your time. And that is, the events that you are observing here are a signpost up ahead for what will happen to the descendants. All the blessing. Genesis is pregnant with blessings. People blessing people, saying words, calling people certain names, changing names. The key point is that what is happening here, the blessings are not for the individual. The blessings are for the generation to come. But the character may be defined, but what you do with that, and this is going to come very big at the end of Genesis, what you do with that, that's going to be up to you. So that's what we're seeing here. The connection of the ladder between heaven and earth, they're connected. I'm the Lord your God. I will make your children as the dust of the earth. Interesting, at the end of Isaiah 51, verse 23, it says they're describing the servant of Israel, who during her exile was laying on the ground and all the nations walked over her. Isaiah, it's really so beautiful. Unfortunately, so few people read it. You don't know what you mean. If you want a good kiss, you want a good hug with God, if you want to just fall in love, you just take it. So the end of 51, read it. Read it and fall in love. It describes, it's all the same language is here. It's all in Isaiah. It's like one, if you understand these texts, this is the greatest symphony. You know, if you go to an orchestra, it's a symphony of instruments, music, harmonies that are all coming into play here. So the text is saying that you were the earth, meaning the nations trampled over you. Rise up, arise, shake your dust off, for no longer will the uncircumcised and the unclean enter Jerusalem, and so on. That's Isaiah 52, all talking about Israel, the servant in the singular, who is hated by the nations and ultimately be raised up at the end of the day. So this is what we're looking at here, is just something, your eyes just pop out. And the Hebrew is so delicious here, but I know time is limited.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was Tovia Singer on 12 lines of text. Imagine what he'll be like on the tour. That's stunning.
Well, that's true. And just to remind everybody, we will be going on the tour. That's November 2015. We're going to be taking 10 days in Israel and quite a few of those in Jerusalem. And we're really looking forward to that. We're doing that with Tovia Singer. Also, Ross Nichols is going to be joining us from rootsoffaith.org.
I just want to jump in there and say what I love about the beginning of this Torah portion up to 29 is the humanness that we see from Jacob. So here's Jacob. He's kind of is a bit insecure about his relationship with his brother, and he leaves the place where he is, and he has a sleep. And during the sleep, he's given this amazing, awesome image and this amazing, awesome dream. And it's just for him. There's no one else around. And then he wakes up and he says, surely this place, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not, which for me raises questions of, because there is a perception that God only lives in certain places, you know, and I think that was maybe a traditional perception at that time. Now people tend to either believe that or that God is omnipresent, but in this instance, you know, Jacob really wasn't expecting to find God there. And so he's seen this amazing thing. He admits that God is there. He names the place that God is there. But then he says, if God is with me and will keep me in this way that I will go, will give me bread to eat and raiment to wear, so I get back to my father's house in peace. And then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, and the rest, and I'll give you a tenth. So even after everything, there's still a part of him that wants to make a bargain or a promise. You know, if I can just get through this day, then I'll know God is with me, even though it's abundantly clear that God is with him. And that, for me, is a really good reflection of the human heart. I mean, I'm aware, chatting to you two, that God completely put me where I am. He puts the roof over my head. He puts the food in my mouth, and he gives me the air in my lungs. But there are still times when I say, you know, God, if you can just get me through this ordeal, or if you could just sort this out for me, then I'll be your golden child. I will be your ace. Yes.
that I can relate to. I really, really can. Yeah.
Jason is touching on something so deep here that I'm falling over. I mean, literally, I'm on an office chair and sort of leaned all the way back. We noticed something very striking. This is just to heighten what Jason had said. And that is that the very righteous and holy people are all asking for a sign. You can go to Hezekiah, who's told that he's deathly ill, and he's told Isaiah, Isaiah the 15, and he asked for a sign. Why would you ask for a sign? You know, why would Gideon ask for signs? And so, and why would wicked people not want signs like Ahaz? What's going on here? That's what Jason, what's happening here is they understand that the blessings come because of their worthiness. God saw Abraham, that he had faith. The question they always had, why did Gideon, if an angel came to you, John, or Jason, would you really say, wait, I'm going to put a fleece outside of my house if it's dry? You would never do that. You would say, but one thing is, you'd wonder if you really had humility, you'd say, but why would he choose me? And that's Moses, the reluctant leader, arguing with God, I shouldn't be the one. When I see people who want to be a leader of Jewish people, we know that these are not the true leaders. People who are running to be a chief rabbi and actually running for, that's not a person who should lead the nation from the Bible. So from the Bible standpoint, all these people just felt unworthy, like, really, really? I'll know that I am worthy if I see these things, because to me, it's inconceivable. Their sense of, so there was a conflation. On one sense, these people understood the importance. They were shocked. Jacob was absolutely stunned that he had this vision. He wasn't prepared to experience prophecy. And as Jason pointed out, he was perplexed by everything, but he understood that this was a unique place. And the text at the end of verse 17 says, because he saw that this was Zeh Shah HaShemayim, that this actually is, he didn't understand this. So the text has the modifier at the end saying, let me explain to you what's unique. What, Jacob didn't know God's all over? No, that this literally is the gates of heaven. When you come on this tour, all I'm going to tell you is bring your Bible with you, because we are going to walk through the Bible. So that's what we see in vision over here. One of the tiny anomalies, there's a very interesting, and that is we see that Jacob collects a whole bunch of rocks before he goes to sleep at night. But when he wakes up in the morning, there's only one rock beneath his head, one stone. We see plural going to the singular.
We see the plural first,
That means, the Medrash says, and the Medrash is using a parable. This is not to be necessarily taken in a hyper-literal way, but the Medrash says the following. The Medrash, again, this is sort of parabolic, this Medrash writing, but yes, so he says he gathered the stones, but when he woke up, there's only one stone. Medrash says that he, in fact, put 12 stones to surround him to protect himself from the elements and so on. And when he was sleeping, the stones began to argue with each other. Just settle there. Don't worry about that. Each stone wanted to be beneath Jacob's head. And ultimately, the stones were assembled into one stone, and that is the only, because each one wanted that privilege, the only way for the Jewish people to be, to reach its complete height is to, in fact, be completely unified as the children of Israel. We're going to see this in view in very beautiful, exquisite view in the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37. Intriguing, the nation is split apart. We have 10 tribes that are lost. We're discovering them now. Please God, the Messiah is coming soon. But, you know, God turns to Ezekiel and he says, take 2 sticks, write one for yes. Judah and his companion, other to Ephraim and his companion. Now, what's very important is, see, God could have said that all the lost tribes are going to be restored, which we see at the end of Ezekiel 47, 48. It's all clear. That means that, but there's something very, very, very delicious here. That's how he says, put the 2 sticks in your hand. So imagine taking 2 sticks, okay? Imagine that. And then putting the 2 ends in the palm of your hand, then close your hand around the ends, and then he opens it, and it's 1 stick. What is essential for the Messianic age, for the world to read its complete perfection, is for the parts, the different stones, to really come into one. Then you can reach your complete height. That is when the nation is unified. And what will those, the accuser and that who wants to harm us, is those who cheat to separate the Jewish people. And that's, in fact, why the Second Temple was destroyed, for the baseless hatred. And that's absolutely historical. The Romans were not interested in destroying the Second Temple. The reason why the Jews went to war with Rome in 66, if you study the history, Rome didn't want to go to war. It was because the Jews were fighting against other Jews, and the Romans stepped in to stand by those elite Jews who were there to collect taxes. And that's where it all began. It began with the intra-Jewish war that the Romans stepped in. The Romans were not Nazis. They weren't David Duke. They weren't the church fathers. Neither were the Babylonians. They simply stepped in, and it was a Jewish war. And that's what destroyed the Second Temple. And it was a Jewish war, and that's the key. The key is that the stones, the 12 tribes, have to be together as one stone. Obviously, stones don't have free will, not really arguing with each other. This is a parable, but parables are the powerful way. It's a mushal. That's why the book of Proverbs is called Mishle. Through using this kind of unique storytelling, this mushal, we are able to, our sages of blessed memory are able to convey over really what might be otherwise complex ideas.
There's another tradition regarding the stone, Jason, and it seems that you and I have spoken about it before, if my memory serves me correctly. You being the Englishman, it's the Stone of Scone. Well, we have spoken about that before, haven't we?
We have, yeah.
That's a wild story.
It is, and it is a story. And, I mean, if you see the Stone of Scone, it's a perfect rectangle. But traditionally, the kings and queens of England and kind of the UK were crowned over it, so we say that the Stone of Scone, depending on where you come from, but I think it's in Scotland. There's a copy of it in Scotland, and it's actually under the kind of the throne in Westminster Abbey where the new kings and queens get throned. But clearly, it's not. I mean,
no, know, clearly it's not. But this is what they claim. They claim that it's the stone that Jacob had under his head at Bet El. Anyway, that's another one. That's
is it just worth
odd.
Mentioning? When they put the oil on to the stone, does that mean it was Mashiach'd?
Yes, very quite literally. That means it was Mashach. Mashach means the word. The Hebrew word there is not Mashach, but he poured oil over. But that means to anoint. That means you're taking something that is the physical, and now I'm going to elevate it, and I'm going to pour oil over it, which is the very best of to take olive and actually extract the oil. You're really extracting the very premium part of it and pour it on it. That's how you consecrate it, and that's what's happening. Vayitzak shemen al roisha, on its head.
Now it's a stone that stands out. Now it's a stone that's set apart, if you like. And this is the first time we see this an anointing occur in the Torah.
Well, you have you can go back earlier where you have not this kind of anointing. You could go to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek is going to make Abraham a priest. So it's not exactly the same. The same. The Hebrew word there is not anoint. So that's an important. The word there is not Moshech. The word is Vayitzok. It means you pour it on him. So we still haven't yet. If one wants to get to that kind of word, so then we're going to be moving into Exodus. Right now, once we're in just something I've said, Genesis is the forming of the royal family, right? The family that chose God. That's the whole overarching theme. Exodus is the forming of the royal nation. Okay, so just if you can keep that very large principle in place, so then all this is going to come into play quite nicely.
So it goes on in chapter 29. Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the people of the east, and he looked around. He saw a well in the field, and behold, there was some flocks of sheep and some guys there. And he said, "Hey, do you know Laban?" And they said, "Oh, we know Laban. Is he well?" They said, "Yeah, he's well. And look, check it out. His daughter is coming." And he looks over the fields, and Rachel has her father's sheep. She was a shepherdess. And it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth, and the water flowed and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass that Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, and he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to the house. And so he told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him for a month. Do you think there was some memories going on for Laban when Eliezer came to
meet Rebekah? Yes, that means he expected love on is really, in classical Jewish literature, considered the most evil of all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, very much so. If you take the name Lavan, Lavan is very much like the pig, who has the outward appearance of... The word Lavan means white. Mm-hmm. That's a very simple word. But behind it is something filthy, is a novel. And that's why if you take his name and just read it backwards, that's what you have. A novel means a shyster, a filthy shyster.
Really?
So you just slam it backwards. He's the ultimate in evil, because he really, we're going to see this throughout this portion, that he is the person who's going to use deceit. Like the pig, why is it that the pig, and we see this is not just our own culture, in the Bible, the pig is like the absolute symbol of everything that's unkosher. It's because the pig, we're told in Leviticus 11, is the only animal that has split hooves but doesn't chew its cud. Outwardly, it looks lovely. Outwardly, it looks white. Outwardly, it looks blemishless, but actually, open it up inside, and you'll see it in fact does not chew its cud, and therefore it represents everything that's filthy, everything that's odious. That's exactly what Lavan is. If you pay careful attention as you go through the text, and you'll see that Lavan has an excuse for everything, that his intentions are best. And an argument could be posited, advanced at every segment, that Lavan is in fact acting out of an altruism, out of goodness. His arguments with Jacob, his reasons, we'll get to that in a moment, all have a reason to explain, but the man is a liar, and he's trying to seduce you and ultimately take what he has. Now, there is one other point I must say, and that is, when you, the listener, were listening to Jono read the text, you must have been going, why this, Jacob is doing this, all these things here, with the stone that's so huge. This city he went to, we're now in Syria, okay? That's where we're in a place, that's a place of Aramaic. We are in modern day Syria. That's where we are right now. Why would the people have a stone so big and heavy that a person can't take it? Jacob was able to somehow do it, but why was it so large? It needed a lot of people to take it, because they wanted to make sure that no one took from their well. What is being conveyed here? I mean, look at verse 10. In verse 10, we have three times in one verse that tells us that Jacob is doing this, that in fact it is because in the merit of his mother, not because of its Lavan's well, but it reminds us three times, it's completely redundant, that Lovin is his mother's brother. The reason this is being driven in constantly, because it's just nonstop, is understand that everything that is happening here is nothing to do. Jacob's going to see right through Lovin. That's going to be, of course, the end. And I don't want to get, we'll get there. But what's happening is Jacob is doing everything in the merit of his beloved mother, who, in fact, knew, his mother knew the truth. So everything is happening in the juxtaposition against people who are acting in truth, who understand, people who are acting completely evil. Lovin is absolutely evil. In fact, in the Haggadah, Lovin is the worst. He wanted to absolutely uproot the nation of Israel completely, and he does it through deceit. We are Israel's friend. We are your friend. We're just working to work with Iran, and don't worry, we are Israel's best friend in the world. And then we have this article coming out in the Atlanta Journal published, where a very high up official saying, actually, I'm not going to get about, it's not important what he said about Bibi, but the key is the administrative body administration official said that, in fact, 3 years ago, Israel could have destroyed Iran's nuclear weapons, and now the assessment is it is no longer possible. What does that all mean? All this time is being used by Lovin, meaning this is what's going on here, saying this is how the enemy works. Sweden is not relevant. It's the one who says, I'm your best friend and we have a bond. That's the one that really is the one you have to watch out for. Because, and then now, what is, people all miss this point. That means the American administration understood very well that it was doing everything possible to prevent Israel from taking away Iran's nuclear program. And therefore, when America's saying now it's irreversible, Israel can't, that's the key point you need to take away. That is the plan. Now, God will stand with Israel, but love on white, but go backwards. Novel's, by the way, name of a guy we're going to see in Samuel, who's a nasty fellow. He's married to Abigail, and all that unfolds.
Ah, that's right.
Ah, yes,
yeah.
yes. That's the word novel, a maneuver. Is a shyster, is a filthy, lying shyster, but who uses who uses deceit constantly, seductively. He's going to love, and ultimately he's going to see that, you're right, Chano, that he's coming, he does not have the great wealth, because he knew about the past. He's actually hugging. If you notice, there's a lot of touching, kissing, grabbing, holding. Nothing vestigial in the text. He's literally feeling him around to see. He's got to have a few pounds of gold somewhere here. And I know what Eliezer did before. That's why there's there's so much touching going on. He's just literally frisking him. You know, sometimes you've watched these magic shows where the person gets up and the magician shakes his hand, puts his arm around him, and then a few minutes later hands him back his watch and his wallet.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's what's happening here. That's what Lovin is. Lovin is Naval. He's filthy. And this is the odious man. We're going to see this unfold right now.
And so he says to him, you're my relative. Should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages shall be. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now, Jacob, these are just romantic verses, I really have to say. Jacob loved Rachel, and so he said, I will serve you 7 years. He volunteers the 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love that he had for her. I just think that's beautiful. Yeah. And then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for the days are fulfilled, that I may go and go into her. And Laban gathered together all the men in one place and made a feast. And it came the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her, and Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid.
I just want to jump in for 1 second there. Notice this is the part of the deception. Bilhah and Zilpah are two sisters who are maidservants of Rachel and Leah. Notice Zilpah is the younger of the two. They're ultimately going to become wives for Jacob as well. But notice that Laban, this is part of the seed. I never do this, but this will be missed. He's giving Leah, the older daughter, Jacob is not going to realize now, she's very well veiled. But he gives Zilpah, the younger of the two maidservants, with allegedly Rachel, but really Leah, in order to heighten the deceit. noticed that. So we'll go ahead.
Right. Okay. And so it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why have you deceived me?" And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve with." So he's saying, "Another, give it another 7 years, and then you can have Rachel."
He's also blaming. He's also, again, because we have this massive deceit. One other point has to be made here. We see the holiness of the matriarchs. Rachel, imagine, she was in love with Jacob. This was not a one-way street. They adored each other. Rachel knew what was going on. She could have raised her voice in the wedding.
A
Jewish tradition tells us, in fact, Jacob knows what Laban's up to, and there was actually a signal set up. This is not in the text. This is in Jewish tradition, but there was a signal set up between Rachel and Jacob, so Rachel could be sure at the wedding that this was, in fact, Rachel. He suspected this. And, in fact, in order to spare Leah the embarrassment, could you imagine if Rachel had walked on the wedding? Or imagine for a moment if Leah did not know the signal. Just imagine any scenario you want, but imagine they're at the wedding. Because look what's happening. This is a big feast. The whole town is there. And imagine the disgrace that would come to Leah. Imagine her. I mean, it's inconceivable embarrassment.
So the idea is that this was spared her by her sister.
Yes, her sister was willing to give it all up, because in Jewish law, if you cause embarrassment to someone else, it's as if you kill them. Literally, it's as if you kill someone. I don't know if you've ever been embarrassed in your life. It's not. You don't need to answer that question. You have. Okay. Literally, when someone is embarrassed, you actually feel heat in your face. Yeah. You get flush. It's literally heat just shoots into your head. I mean, it's literally, there is a physiological change. I mean, so what we're seeing here is that Rachel is giving up her beloved. She does not know that a deal is going to be worked out in a moment. That she doesn't know this. But Rachel is agreeing to all this to spare her sister the unimaginable embarrassment of this unfolding at the wedding canopy, that in fact it's not the correct bride. So that's a point that has to be made here.
It's fair to make, because like I said, I mean, she could have raised her voice. She could have protested against what was going on, but she didn't. Clearly she did not. Jacob ends up with Leah. And Laban said, so another 7 years.
He blames it on the community. He blames it on the. He actually blames it on someone else.
Yeah, it's not our culture. We can't
Obama,
do that.
It wasn't me. It was some guy else. Yeah. We're not responsible. It's not us. It's something else. It's the norms.
So why not mention it the first time? You know, why not mention? Well, you know, first we've got to marry Leah off, and then we've got to do it by deception, and that's what happens. But it's interesting, of course, that. It has to be mentioned again that Jacob receives the blessing of the firstborn by deception as well. Is there a little bit coming back to him here?
Everything is going to come back, and we're going to see everything coming back. In fact, we're going to see that, in fact, Jacob did leave his family for 20 years. Now, there was an additional 22 years. There was an additional 14 years that he was studying, but he in fact, abandoned his family for 20 years. And in fact, there's a humiliation that he brought to Rachel later on. We're going to see this come back to Jacob. And that is that there will be a day, not very long, not far away from where we are right now, that Jacob is going to think he's standing in front of the vice president of Egypt and he's going to be humiliated in front of his own son. So, and in fact, the distance of time of how long he went without seeing his son Joseph is the exact same distance of time that his parents didn't get to see him. So that's why the Torah is going to give us time zones here, because the Torah is saying these are all connected, that ultimately Jacob had a reason, but ultimately it was way too long. Jacob may have come up with an alternative method scheme for getting Rachel, who he loved, who he was supposed to be with. And in fact, that kind of distance ultimately is all going to come full circle. We can see the same time. The Torah is alerting us using these signposts, because it's saying, one, ultimately, there's humiliation. There's ultimately Jacob is going to be in the same position on a grand scale a little bit toward the end of his life.
So Jacob, he served another 7 years. And so Laban gave his daughter Rachel as a wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. And therefore Jacob went into Rachel and he loved Rachel more than Leia. Oh, wow. But that's, it's hard to read, isn't it? Because anyway, but this is the case. And he served Laban still another 7 years. So there's 21 years that he's serving Laban. And the passages that follow, goodness, boy, I tell you, Jacob's pretty busy. But here we have the 12 tribes. Do you want to summarize this for us, Tobia?
Well, we're going to see Leah is going to produce half of the tribes of Israel. We're going to, I mean, that's what's happening here. God has opened her womb, and and she is so grateful to Hashem for the children that is being given. Yeah. And she's going to ultimately, we see the position, I know what's troubling you. I know your pain. And the pain is to see, well, because we're not in a polygamous society.
No, but Leia knows that she's not the preferred wife, that her husband loves her younger sister more so than she is loved. And you can feel it throughout this whole thing. And yet God seems to feel it also, and he blesses her with the most children.
There is the destiny also, of course, and that is you, the listener. We hope that you will be joining us as we are in Hebron. Ultimately, Leia will be the one to spend... to be buried next to Jacob, not Rachel. And it will be Rachel who's going to be buried. This is going to come up, and it's all over the place. But really what happens is this is ultimately always the justice. And that is that Leah is buried next to, Jacob. Rachel is not buried there. She's buried. We'll be there too. And that's on the way. If you go from Jerusalem, go just south, you go right past Bethlehem, which is Rachel's going to be the one that's going to be watching her children coming in from the exile, very much as Jacob returning in from the exile from Syria. It all is so full circle. Leah is buried in the land of Israel. She's buried, not only in the land of Israel, she's buried next to her husband. And we're going to be there. This in Hebron, the Marsa Machpelah, the place where the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried, is the second holiest site on earth, and we'll be there. It's Hebron.
We're certainly planning to be there. So I haven't been there yet, and I'm really looking forward to it. Jason, you wanted to spotted something curious in chapter 30, verse 8.
Yeah, I just want Toby's opinion. In verse 8, it says that, so we've gone through this adoption process of having the people give birth on the knee, which is kind of an adoption thing. But then in verse 8, and Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed. And in my little notes, under my, which book is this? Pentateuch and Half Torah book. It says mighty wrestlings literally means wrestlings with God. So I was wondering if there was anything attached to this.
Yeah, so what we have here is kind of, so here's what's going to happen. We are now going to encounter some of the strangest texts in the book of Genesis, literally. We are about to walk, we're literally at the door of one of the very difficult passages to understand. And this is the setup. That's what's happening here. We notice that Rachel obviously is praying to God, and she's angry. And she at her husband, and Jacob is, turns back to her and says, no, we don't have intercessors. You pray directly to God. That's what he's saying. You don't come to me to pray to God. You just talk to God yourself. What is going to happen here is that Rachel, ultimately, although she's praying, there is going to be something that's going to trigger her opening of the womb. And what is the transition? So the transition, she can't have children. And then something very, very odd happens. That's a setup here. That's what the language is going on. And that is that you need to place your body where your prayer is. And that we're about to encounter following this. That's why this language is about luck, and it's about what you can do, and it's about schemes. You can't just sit. I had a fellow, listen, I'm not going to say his name, who was in the Messianic movement for a very long time. And he watched the debate and so on, and now he's saying, he doesn't quite believe anymore in Christianity, but he needs to pray for a sign. I said, just go into the Bible, submerge yourself. It's there. What will you do if Hare Krishna comes to you? Would he become a Hindu? So you have to, place your body where your prayer is. So you have to actually take the step. And that's what's going to happen now. That is a very strange story. And that is that Reuven, that's what we're going to now, is it goes into the field and he brings back this plant. There's a disagreement of exactly what this plant is. It's called Dudaim. The word dod means love. Anila dodi vla dodi li, Song of Songs. It means my beloved. So we have a plant that's sort of an aphrodisiac that has this exquisite smell. The Septuagint comes up with, I forgot, in which the English King James uses, but that's really from what plant it is.
Mandrakes.
Yeah, yeah, so that's mandrakes. The source for that is the Septuagint quotation marks. But the point is, the Torah is not interested. The word is, the key word is du da'im. The word dod means love. So we have a love plant. That's what's being stated here. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Torah is not interested. It's not important. And what's happening is that Reuven brings it home for his mother, Leah, this plant. What happens is that Rachel now has been praying, but she actually is going to do something. This is a plant that God has made that has an exquisite, let's just say it has an exquisite odor that is very, that creates an environment of intimacy, and it creates, it heightens intimacy, and would also make a woman more fertile. It's a plant of conception. That's what we're looking at right now. But it's a very physical plant that has this medicinal kind of quality. What happens is Rachel actually does it, meaning she does something to get pregnant, and she actually goes to the fertilization clinic, meaning she does what was done. She makes a deal with her sister. But the key point is, you'll notice it is only then when she takes that extra step that if you go right after that, says that God heard her prayers, heard her cries, saw tears. Well, God didn't hear them before. They were there before, but she had to do that thing. You need to step in and go into the Bible. Stop just saying, I'm going to pray over this. I hear it all my life. But get into it. Plunge in. There's a tradition when the sea was parted, there was one fellow, Nachshon. He walked into water, and the water had to hit the nostrils. We see it today in the state of Israel. You'd have to have an army. Of course, it's God. Of course, Jerusalem liberated is God. Everyone knows it's miraculous. But you have to have the planes and the pilots and the soldiers, and then they'll be blessed. And what does this all mean? So why do we need to? The answer is, we always have to connect the physical to the spiritual. We're not living in the Gnostic world where the physical and spiritual are completely disconnected. No, we're living in the world of Jacob's dream. That's the whole connection. And that is heaven and earth, our connection. You need the plant. God put it there for a purpose, and therefore you need to connect the plant from the ground, and then your prayers will be heard. It's really exquisite what's happening here. And that's why these are difficult to understand without the theme. The theme is, you must take the physical and lift it up to the spiritual. You've got to work in this world as a real world. Jacob is going to go to war with his brother, but he actually sets up camps. He's going to use methods in order to get his strange-looking sheep and goats to be his. We'll get to that soon. But he's actually doing things. We'll talk about the strategies that are happening, but you need to be doing them strategy. You need to have Mossad. Then God will hear your prayers, and God is going to hear her prayers after she takes these conception plants, these plants that induce conception and fertility, and
she made an assertive step forward by saying to
her body into a prayer. It's what happened.
That's what happened. And she said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes or whatever they were. And she said to her, oh, is it a small matter that you take away my husband? Would you also take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, and therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. And so the deal was done. And when Jacob came back from the field, Leah came out to meet him and said, you must come into me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And so he lay with her that night. God listened to Leah. And she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband. And so she called his name Issachar. And then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. And so she called his name Zebulun. And after that, she bore the daughter and called her name Dinah. And then God remembered Rachel.
Right.
And God listened to her. And yeah.
Yeah, well, just a little point here. Zebulun locks it up. You have to understand there's a numbers issues here. And that is, if Leah would have had it, what suddenly is the daughter in there? That means you're stopping Leah from producing any more tribes. Because if Leah is going to produce more tribes, then what's going to happen is Rachel will be the one with the fewest children. So therefore, it's stopped right there. It's sealed with Zebulun. You're going to have Dinah, who is the girl who's born. Mm. And that, of course, she's not going to convey over a tribal identification. So Leah stops short. She produces 6 of the 12 sons. So therefore, what was very important is we could not have Rachel having only one child. And in fact, Yosef is the name. I know I'm getting ahead, but everything... I'm not being a bad boy on air with you guys by sort of giving it away. I'm not cheating. What's happening is the text is setting, every text we have is setting up for the text that follows it. So everything's a setup for what's about to follow. And I one thing is I want everyone to like me more than Jason and Jono. That's the most important reason why I'm on air. I want them to say,
Pills is all about.
Yeah, Jason, all right, whatever. It's all about. That's the most important reason why I'm jumping ahead. So that's the reason so that I get a salary. I can demand a better contract for next year's broadcasting. Saying, look, so that's my main reason. It's selfish. But there is another reason. That is, the text is doing this. And that's why we see an anomaly, but it's really a setup for what's about to come.
Mm, mm. And so this, and of course, this is God opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach of not having children, obviously. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. Mm. And now, and this is interesting. It came to pass that after Rachel had born Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, let me go. Let me go and, you know, let me start my own life and, you know, my wife and my children, and we'll go and do this and that. And they're discussing this. And he says, look, let me just take the flocks that are, you know, they would have spots on them, you know, the spotted flocks, if they got splotches.
They're not the pretty. They're not, they don't come out.
No, yeah, they've got these marks on them, and I take them. And you can have the whole colored ones. You got the beautiful herd and or the flocks of sheep and so on and so forth. And they make this deal. And what follows is something kind of like a science experiment, Tobia. Now, I don't know if I've told you this, Tobia, but I have a herd of goats.
I still can't. I'm going to feel like getting on AirAsia and flying to you to see this. but actually, now, I hugged you in Israel, I could smell that. I'm joking.
You could smell the goat.
No, I'm kidding. That's not true. That I made that up because it was a cheap joke, and why not?
Now, I also happen to have an almond tree, or a couple of impressive almond trees. And I did do the experiment. We have the water trough there, and I thought, you know what, I will do the experiment. I took some almond branches, I stripped them open, I put them in with the water, because the way that I read it here in my New King James made it sound like that if I put almond branches in the water in such a way that strips the bark open bare, then something happens to the water and acts as some sort of genetic,
Do you have only one tree mentioned in your passage?
I've got 3, actually. I do have 3, but I don't have those other trees. I forgot. Now, in mine, it says also a poplar tree. I'm not so familiar with that. It also says a plane tree or a, what's the other tree that's mentioned there? I think it depends on which translation you're using. But it seemed to suggest to me that if one was to conduct such an experiment, it would serve to choose, I suppose, the genetics of the way the offspring would appear. Now, they did drink from the trough. They did kid recently, only a matter of weeks ago, and they're all plain-colored goats. Mm. There's nothing unusual about them. They're all plain-colored goats like their parents. Now, I read it in my Jewish study Bible, and the interesting thing is that it seems to be the understanding, whether it's true or not, I mean, whether it actually works this way or not, it certainly did for Jacob, but it seems to be his understanding that it's not so much a mixture in the water, but something that he intends the flock to see,
yes.
And the seeing is what he believes chooses the genetic appearance of the lambs. Is this so the way you understand
there's
it?
There's 2. It's not. We're going to actually see this in the text. We'll see what happens. There are two strategies going on. There's his strategy and there's God's strategy, and that's what the rods are there for. The rods ultimately are going to be a visual block to that love. See, just for those who understand, obviously, when we say that an animal has this weird spotted all over the place, that means the norm is you have, I imagine a white sheep with a, and her husband, whatever they call a male, whatever it is, a ram. So they make white babies, I could presume. Mm-hmm. But you occasionally have the anomaly of a stripe mm-hmm. of this oddity. Now, that would come up. We studied about this in school. This is very important to know about sheep and goats, as opposed to deer and giraffe. And that is that sheep and goats cannot outrun lions and tigers. They can't. Mm-hmm. They just, if you look at them, these are not gazelles. These are not animals that could escape. So, but we know in the real world, there has to be some sort of method that how do animals survive when they can't outrun their, well, what they do is they camouflage, and the ones that survive are the ones that look like what is around them, that appear like these environments around them. So therefore, what would then happen is they would be better camouflaged. We're going to see later that really the purpose, although that's Jacob's strategy, that the animal, again, if you have a sheep that somehow looks like its environment, therefore would be difficult for predators to find it. It would produce mm-hmm. And Jacob is going to use the strategy to outsmart Laban. We're going to see that the benefit of all this really is not just to produce a lot of animals. We're actually going to see that doesn't work. We're going to actually see that what happens is he sees that the animals are constantly mating with each other, particularly the marked ones with the marked ones, and Jacob is brought to see these animals mate. I should tell you a very intriguing Talmud that says, in Jewish tradition, one is not mm-hmm. supposed to look upon two animals mating. There's it's not one of 613 commandments, but it's not considered a proper thing. That means, and we're supposed to learn from cats that mate in private. We're supposed to learn being modest and so on and so forth. So when Jacob is shown this strange mating going on, that means Hashem is intervening here, producing a lot of striped animals by actually having them mate and say, look what God is doing here. He's having the animals mate in such a way that would keep producing these anomalies, which means for those who forgot what John just said a moment ago, the agreement was that if the animal comes out white or black or just a normative color, they go to Laban. If they come out strange and spotted, which is the anomaly, they be going Jacob. Well, God is, so Jacob does the best he can to produce, but what is going to happen here is not so much the genetic. God is going to step in here, cause this mating of the right animal with that animal to produce these bizarre animals, mm-hmm. and meaning animals that would fill Jacob's flock. So he's stepping yep. in. And number two is Laban really can't see what's going on because these rods ultimately, as they're unfurled, become like a fence. So therefore, Laban doesn't quite get it. So this is all happening, and Laban doesn't realize what's occurring. But what is happening is something not natural is occurring. That is, Jacob's anomaly flocks are just flying all over, but they have these rods up and that are expanded or unfurled, so he can't see it. So it's not so much the biology of the animal will want to take on the environment in order to be camouflaged. These animals are not like deer that can run like the wind. But what is going to happen here is God's going to step in. But again, Jacob has to work in the material world to the best that he can.
The best that he can, yeah. And that's what seems to be going on. Jason.
Yeah, well, my mind's just been blown because I think I've taken something from what Toby has just said, and I'm rereading the text as he's saying it. And I thought for the whole of my life that there was some sort of sciencey thing happening with these sticks. But now when I reread it with what Toby's just said, I'm kind of thinking that, Jacob is this master shepherd. It says at the beginning there that every step that Jacob has made, Laban's profited by. So he's really great at increasing the herd and the flock. Mm. And it really seems to me now that he got these sticks and put these strips on them and put them in the water, knowing that they would cause a natural barrier and a kind of a camouflage defense from Laban. So Laban won't be able to see what's happening at these sticks.
Because I've never, the way I read it now is that they're standing up in the water at the shots. They're not lying down. Like,
yeah.
So I've got no chance with my almond trees. I'm not going to produce any. This is just devastating because I really wanted splotchy little kids. But anyway.
Well, maybe your goats are going to taste like almonds. You don't know yet.
Maybe.
Jacob separates the lambs and he moves them into different areas. And then it says at the end here, but when the flock were feeble, he didn't put them in. So the feebler ones were Laban's because he didn't put them in that pen. They didn't get spots. So the weaker lambs were the pure lambs. And the stronger ones, the ones he did put into this pen. Which shouldn't be the case.
Which shouldn't be the case. You'd think that the animals that have anomalies would be the one that would be, you know, weaker. Everything is working his way.
Mm. But because of his animal husbandry and his skills, he's managed to kind of separate them. And I think that's awesome. So the man increased exceedingly and he had larger flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses. And that's fantastic for some clever farming. Yeah.
Mm. He is. Now, Toby, I have to pick up on something you said. You said it's something that we should avoid to watch animals mating. I have to say,
Go ahead. It's just the Talmud says that in Tractate of Avodah Zarah, that in general, if you see animals mating, you should turn away. I mean, it doesn't mean...
I would be spinning around here on the farm. I don't know what's going on with my ducks and my chickens and the dog and the cat and the goats and the sheep, but it's always something happening in some corner of the farm. And maybe it's because it's spring. Anyhow, let's move on. So we're in chapter 31, and it says that Jacob heard the words of Laban's son saying, Jacob has taken away all that our father... Ah, there. Look, Jacob's getting stronger. We can't have that.
Right.
Tobia.
Yeah. So that's what's happening is, you know, I have to do this. I don't care. It's so delicious. You know, what's happening before the 67 war, it's Jacob and Laban. The Egyptians are making it. We're only doing all kinds of exercises in the Sinai. We're not really going to war. And Israel actually starts on Levi Eshkol when they see at the end that they have to go to war. They start making like they're not going to do anything. And then they strike. And what they do is they come in under the radar. The planes are flying. I spoke to pilots who flew in the 67 war and they flew in exactly 7 o'clock in the morning, no radio contact at all, and they're flying these French Mirage jets, and the pilot told me, I've spoken to a number of them who were, that they were flying about something like 100 feet off the water, so not to be picked up by the radar. So, I mean, which is, the pilot explained to me that the amount of concentration you need when you're flying at whatever it is, I don't know, but let's say there's 800 miles an hour, he explained to me, you can't even blink because at that super speed, you have no... You look away for 1 second, and they come in, They knew, the Israelis knew exactly when the Egyptians were doing what, and they strafe the takeoff places. That's the first thing is they bomb, so the planes can't even get out. So that's what we're seeing. These events that are unfolding here, then the Egyptians realize, oh my God, what's happening here? And then Israel can come in and they can bomb the whole air force just laying there. And then the enemy finally realizes what happened to me. Of course, it's too late then, because Israel really wins the 67 war in the first hours. Israel then controls all the air. That's what we're seeing here. We're seeing here how to deal with your enemy. If your enemy is deceitful, you have to out-deceit them, and then God will hear your prayers. But you have to realize that we're living in a world of the latter. It is not a chasm. It is not the Gnostic concept that you need a mediator. The heaven and the earth touch each other, and you must make them touch. You must have a ladder in your life. We are not living in some amorphous world of we're praying over this and praying over this and tongues. No, you take the physical world, you lift the physical world to the spiritual, and that's Judaism. And welcome home.
Welcome home. And so Laban, he said, Jacob saw that the countenance of Laban indeed was not favorable towards him as before. And the Lord said to Jacob, now's the time, sunshine, return to the land of your fathers with your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent for Rachel and Leah and to the field, to his flocks, and he said to them, look, your father's countenance is not favorable towards me as
the
before.
The veil is down. That means...
The veil's down.
Yeah, that means they were kissing and hugging, whatever it was, but now everybody knows everything is going down. The relationship is now doomed.
It's over. over.
Yeah.
But the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father, with all my might, yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. 10 times. And he said, thus, that the speckled shall be your wages, and all the flocks bore speckled. And then he said that the streaked shall be your wages, and that all the flocks bore streaked. And so God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. Brilliant. But obviously he's... Laban's pretty ticked off. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams, and here we are, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. And the messenger of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and get out of this land and return to the land of your family. And then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we to be considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and has also completely consumed our money. That he's consumed their money? Tovia, what does this mean?
Yeah, that means this is very traumatic, because this means it's the end. This is the closing of the relationship. The big explosion is going to happen, but they're now wondering, remember, we're talking about property here. Does this mean that we are now severed completely?
We're about to be cut off.
Now. Yeah, Laban would have killed. It's very important. Laban would have killed Jacob if he could, but God intervenes. When we see that kind of intervention, where Laban is made to understand, do not harm that man. Okay, so we see that kind of extreme intervention. We have a complete severing. Laban realizes the game is over. There's a tremendous trauma here, where we're going to see what's happening, where Laban's own idols are going to be taken by his own daughter. And then we're going to see where Laban is going to try to destroy the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And you'll see it in a moment spiritually. And this is why in Haggadah it says, and Laban sought to destroy the nation, everything. He was worse than Pharaoh, worse than everybody. I'm going to see that in a moment. So this is tremendous trauma. Laban, in fact, is this going their own ways now. That's it. They're going to actually build a monument that says, this is it. One, your side is your side, your side is that side. We're going to see the language here. It's going to blow your mind away. So this is, but let's continue. I don't want to.
He's acting with some haste, isn't he? For all these riches, they say, with all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, let's do it. And then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and his possessions which he had gained and acquired livestock which he had gained in Padan Aram to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Jason, what's going on here? Verse 19.
So we see this piece where now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, which takes a long time, and especially then they had no electric shears. It would have all had to been done with little flint cutters. And Rachel stole the teraphim that were her father's. So in some Bibles you might find gods or idols or statues. The tradition here, the Jewish tradition, is that Rachel took those to stop Laban being able to idolatize in the house. And that might be true. I kind of lean towards the fact that she maybe wasn't sure that she was brought
maybe
they're up.
Pieces of sentimental, maybe they're
right,
sentimental
yeah, she's
value.
Not, yeah, just like Jacob made that deal at the beginning with, I know they're all this amazing stuff you've shown me, but if you'll do this, then there may have been a small part of her that, because she was brought up in that household, still perhaps felt that she needed them.
Maybe it's because she doesn't want her father to be able to divine where they have gone. Is that a possibility as well? Because we see Laban mention such a thing, that he, I think, a little later on. Tovia, what's going on here? She takes the household gods.
Well, the teraphim are, traditionally looked on as little statues, little idols. She wants to prevent. We're going to see this device is going to backfire. It's not going to work. But she's trying to prevent her farther from doing this. One point I just that's happening here is there is the deception on Jacob's part. Notice how he leaves the city. He doesn't tell Lavan that he is fleeing, because Lavan would have stopped it, would have prevented it. And he leaves, if you notice, and he goes out with a whole entourage. And that's very important, because if Jacob would have left at night, people in the community, remember, we now know something about this community. They use big stones over the well because they're working together to prevent anybody else from getting their stuff. Yep. So they're a community that is very tight. It's a very tight community. And if they would have seen that Laban's interests were being harmed, what would they have seen? They would have witnessed Jacob at night, in the middle of the night, hiding all the wealth. But he's actually going out walking as though Laban had given permission. There was no problem. So he walks out like with just all the grandeur walking out. That's the deception. That means everyone in the community goes, well, if he's walking around with this, with everything, then obviously he's not sneaking out. So that's part of the plot that's happening here.
Right. And so he pursues them, and Laban catches up, and he says, look, he's acting like everything you've taken, it's all mine. All this that you've taken is mine, and you didn't even let me kiss my sons and my daughters, and you just up and left. But why did you take my gods? Why did you steal my gods? Is what Laban says to him. And Jacob answered and said, because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force, but with whomever you find your gods, do not let him live in the presence of our brethren. Identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Mm. Now, there's some speculation that those words may have had a part to play in Rachel's premature death. Is that the curse of the husband upon it? I mean, he didn't know that he was placing a curse on Rachel. Is that
so? It's our Rachel to take away idolatry would have been a positive thing. She didn't die as a punishment, but there is a. But everything is conflating together. Remember, if Rachel had not died at this juncture, she would not have been buried in Beis Lechem. I mean, the text is very clear, so know that I'm not reading anything. She's buried in Beis Lechem on the road. In fact, we are going to go to Rachel's tomb. It's right there. I mean, on the road in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. It's a place that's been... So what's very important is... there is a prophecy, Kol Yomar Adinoi, Kol Bromo Nishma. This is Jeremiah 31:15, which means what's really happening here is Rachel is placed there as a very important on the road, that she is weeping for her children, and she will not be comforted because Ki Inenu, because they're not. That means that she's standing there waiting for her children to return. The holy Jeremiah, the holy prophet, is saying that, look, this woman who endures so much, ultimately you are going to return, ultimately you are going to come back. When we do something, we have to weigh a whole bunch of choices. Each one has advantage and disadvantage, and we choose one and one other suffers, but the best choice is what wins. What's happening here is everything conflates perfectly in God's world. Jacob uttered this out without realizing that Rachel was the one who took it. She took it for very good reason, and there is a concept that you don't let your, if you have a friend and you go to a party and your friend's drunk, you take away his car keys. Mm. And if he gets in the car and starts the car, it is morally correct to just reach into the car, grab the car keys, they do not belong to you, and run with them, not to let him drive. Okay, sure. So that is a completely moral action on the part of someone who's trying to prevent somebody else from doing it. And that's what she's doing here for her father. She has to actually die. We're going to see this because she's not going to be buried with Jacob. She's going to be right there on the border, basically, right, as a signpost, and we'll see that later in Jeremiah 31, verse 15. So I don't know that she's not dying as a punishment. That's what I want people to understand. Right. She's not dying as a punishment, but there is everybody's signpost. A word goes out, a word means everything. A name means everything. Jacob is prophetically saying this. He doesn't realize it. That's what's happening here. She's dying because this is her time, her life has come to an end. People are no longer... lifespans are going down very dramatically to 120 as promised. So lifespans are flying down now, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to talk about it now because this show's gone so long, but there's a reason why it doesn't happen suddenly. It's a natural force. So she's dying. She dies where she needs to be, exactly where she needs to be. Mm-hmm. But of course, Jacob sends out a word. He's a prophet. He doesn't realize that he's actually prophesying something that is imminent to happen. It's not a punishment.
Right. Okay. Now, you made mention that they set up a witness between each other, a heap of stones, a great heap of stones as a witness.
I want to go to the names. This is very critical. Because here's, we're going to, and Jacob took a stone, raised his mom, and Jacob said, okay, so we have the stones, but look what happens here. This is really, Lavan is now warned everything, but Lavan is still going to try to destroy the Jewish people. I want to just jump to verse 37, 47. I think it's Mem Zayin. Vayikra loy Lavan. Lavan calls the name Yigar Sohadusa. This is a very rare event, my friends, and that's Aramaic in the five books of Moses. Okay. So what now? Why Aramaic? Because Aramaic is a cousin language to Hebrew, but it is a conflated language from other Semitic languages. So what? Notice what's going to happen. We're going to see this tension happening. Lavan is still trying to infuse Aramaic, which means in a foreign language. And so Vayikra loy Lavan Yigar Sohadusa. That is, by the way, the Aleph at the end, that's the definite article. This is a complete Aramaic construction. And it's hard Aramaic. Now, what happens? Now, normally when you have an agreement, that means we're agreeing on something. So you have to use the same language. I mean, you've got to have, you're signing off on this. But no, Yaakov says, Yaakov kara loy Galed, which means the same thing. This mound is a witness. But he's going, no, we're Hebrew now. This is the Jewish people here. We're Aver. Mm. We're on the other side. This prohibition of not to walk past. Now, we're going to see something huge, if I may, because we're going here. So what happens is, Al-Kain Karashmai Galed, next verse, verse 48, the name is called Galed. It means Jacob insists Hebrew. We're not going to talk Merry Christmas. Now, if you think that's going to be more, look what's going to happen here. Just going a few more verses, and that is they're going to each call upon God to be as a witness. But look what happens here. This is what Lavan really tries to destroy the Jewish people.
In 53, it says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and then
that's,
Jacob offered
sacrifice. That's an explosion. That's an explosion. I don't know, everyone saw what happened here. What did Lavan, that piece of filthy, that novel, that's who he really is. What is this piece of filth? Mm. This is the last moment. You know, it was, you know that in World War II, at the end of the Holocaust, so the Nazis realized they were going to lose. Hitler realized he was losing. So he actually is pulling men off the front in order to go send them to Auschwitz because he didn't finish off the Jews. It really should have been the other way. Lavan here makes his attempt to destroy the Jewish people. And it's right in that passage. What did he say? Who did he swear to? The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. Who's the God of Nahor? That's idols. His father was an idol worshiper. Nahor's brother, that means that he's trying to say, yes, we pray to the father and then in somebody else's name. And what do? You say, that's offensive. And that's what Jacob says, no. The word here I don't know how the translations have it here, but Vayishava, see, it's the exact same thing. Lavan, you see the way he slides in. Lavan tries to use Aramaic. Yaakov says, no, it's going to be Hebrew. Same thing is happening here. This piece of filth who calls himself white, but now it's all unmasked. He says, I'm swearing by the father, but also some other god, idol. Mm-hmm. What is the response? Look at how delicious the response is that that Jacob returns and he swears, Befachad Aviv Yitzchak. The word there is fear, but read the word fear as capital. That means this is the God of Isaac who could ultimately will bring fear to the enemies of God. So Jacob is swearing in the name of only the God of his father Isaac, not of Nachor. And that's a correction to love. But you see how he's going.
He's qualifying.
Right. That means he's saying no. You see what's happening. Lavan tries to do Aramaic. He says, no, this is going to be Hebrew. He says, oh, we pray to the Father too. We believe in the same God you believe in, but also the God of Nachor. No, I swear by the fear of Isaac, which is capital F, means the God of Isaac, what's being introduced here. That's to the last moment, you see Lava now, because now the veil is gone. And now they're going goodbye. They're setting this up. And and ultimately Jacob wins because he doesn't compromise on his principles. He doesn't ever give in. He is Tom-ish. This is going back to what Jacob was when we introduced him. He was a man of Tom who was perfection, and he was a man of the tent. He was a man who visualized the ladder between heaven and earth, and he knows that they're now completely connected. And ultimately, it's the God of Yitzchak, not the God of Nachor. That's what's happening here.
Amen. And then Laban departed, and he returned to his place, and so Jacob went on his way, and the messengers of God met him. Imagine it. The messengers of God met him, and when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp, and he called the name of that place
Machanayim, which is Machanayim. Stanley in Israel. In Israel today, Yes. They actually, that's the name of a very famous camp, like sleepaway camp, summer camp, is Machanayim. But that's the name only in Israel. But so the angels, so it's full story. He sees the angels going up and down, meaning connecting heaven and earth. And then at the end, he's coming in with the physical everything. He's made the physical separation, and he's greeted by angels, spiritual beings. It's all together, the physical and spiritual.
Isn't it amazing, though, that, I mean, that's the way the Torah portion ends. I find it so curious that, and that's all we have of that little encounter. He encounters messengers of God. He sees them camped, two camps, I think it is, camps that are of messengers of God. And so he calls that, you know, that's the camps. And then we move on from there into the next Torah portion. That's all.
But camps, again, is what we have in view here is there's a temple of heaven, temple on earth. We see this in Isaiah 6. God is sitting on a throne. His robe is so long that God's in the heaven, but his robe goes down to the earth. I can't go into 1 Chronicles 26. It's way outside of the scope of this program in real time. That's everything is about. There's a heavenly temple and an earthly temple, and they have to be in synchronization. There are angels that work outside the land of Israel. We'll see this in Daniel. They're assigned to outside. They escort Jacob to the boundary. But we have camps because once Jacob steps over the line into the land of Israel, he's now welcomed by those angels who are assigned to the land of Israel. And that's what's happening. It's just an you know, like you have watch a fireworks thing, and at the end they have this
the big crescendo.
Right. Yeah. That's what's happening here. It all comes together. Now we get what's going on. Now there's no mediator. It's heaven and earth touching each other, and you can do it.
And what a timely confirmation for Jacob. And we are finished with the Torah portion. Next week we're going to be, he's going to be meeting up with his brother Esau, who he hasn't seen in a very long time. That's going to be very interesting. But you've been listening to Season 2 of Torah Pearls. Thank you, Jason, Spiritual Babies of spiritualbabies.net. Any parting thoughts, my friend?
It is, when you listen to this show, people, it's going to be the end of November. You will have 11 and a half months in which you could be getting ready for the biggest and best Israel tour of your lives.
That's right.
Sign up now, go to truthu.org, maybe, who knows, in 11 months you'll be on the coach, on the bus with us, listening and learning and reading your Tanakh in the land with all your friends and family.
It's very exciting. It's very exciting. Limited places left, dear friends, so you need to put a deposit down if you want to be part of that. Tovia Singer is going to be on the bus. Ross Nichols will be there. I'll be there. Jason, you're hoping to save your pennies and be there. I can't wait. It's going to be very, very exciting next week. And Tovia, thank you. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on and sharing with us in the Torah portion and being the very trying week that it has been. And we certainly hope to see some good news next week as we continue on in the Torah portion next week. Vayishla, Genesis 32 verse 4 to 36 verse 43. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.